Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Right now, let's go on the phone to the man that is the one, the only, Doctor of History, Dr. History.
Morning, Zeb. How you doing?
Well, we're hanging in, hanging on. We're at a little bit lower level on the power than we like. It may be a little hard to hear you this morning, but we'll do our best. And what's going on in the world of historical stories and the memories of the past?
Okay, we're going to go back a long ways back, a little over 200 years.
Oh, your birthday.
1792.
Oh, okay.
All right, so there's a mysterious young American, and he was experiencing a world that as yet had been unnamed and unimagined. And this was, you know, a dozen years before Lewis and Clark started their expedition.
Okay.
But this bold American adventurer, he was only 20 years old, had just spent 2 years traveling and living with the people of one of the most remote and least known western regions of this continent. And exactly what Philip Nolan did and where he went in 1791 and 1792 is kind of hard to really figure out exactly, but we do know that he was a native of Natchez and that he had secured a passport and trading license from the Spanish governor of Louisiana and Florida. Now, otherwise, his adventure exists only in kind of the barest outline. He followed in the footsteps of French traders from Louisiana, who had made their way into the villages like those at the Mandan and the Hidatsas and on the Missouri, and then even as far west as the Comanches. But if we accept the sketchy references to this adventure, this Nolan, Philip Nolan, favorably impressed the Comanches, and it was a people with a highly developed regard for the kind of the masculine virtues with American wilderness skills, and the Comanches in turn showed Nolan a country that hardly any Euro-Americans had seen. And he was deep in the plains where they traveled. So the early 1790s seldom springs to mind when we consider important periods in the history of the American West, but for the southern stretches of the West, Nolan's barely known trip would prove significant indeed. What had drawn Philip Nolan west in the first place was a dream of wealth. But in his case, it wasn't gold or precious metals or even beaver, furs, things like that. Horses are what interested him, and feral horses that over the previous century had spread all across the Southwest. Now, the French, Spanish traders in Louisiana had shown Nolan how to build corrals and to catch these. The Spanish word, I think, is mestinos, or wild ones, mustangs. And Nolan was becoming good at it, but after 2 years with the Comanches, he'd come to understand that just as traders in the north could barter with the Indians for the furs, American traders didn't have to build pens and corral the wild herds. They could just go buy horses and mules that did so well on the southern frontier directly from the Comanches. So they didn't have to go out and hunt them. And the Comanches had so many animals that they were said, quote, to us like grass. In other words, they had so many horses, they didn't know what to do with all of them. But that information, along with the skills he developed running and corralling wild horses, was all Nolan needed. He would mount a second expedition into the country he called the Great Plains in 1794-95, and a third one in 1795-96, and when he returned from his third trip, Nolan took 250 Mustangs all the way to Frankfort, Kentucky, where his striking western animals brought as much as $150 apiece.
Mm.
That was in 1797. I mean, $150, that would have been a lot of money back then.
Absolutely.
But he was set on doing a fourth expedition, and he had $7,000 in trade goods. And this time he returned in 1798, and they were driving a herd estimated between 1,000 to 2,500 horses. Well, Philip Nolan was on his way to becoming a legend. He'd begun something destined to outlive him by decades. But anyway, with the first two-year journey that he went on, he actually got out clear out here by the Rocky Mountains, and he became known as the Mexican Traveler. And he'd actually launched one of the kind of intriguing yet little-known big stories in the history of the early American West. And I'm going to bet hardly anybody's heard of this guy named Philip Nolan.
No, I have not. I had not.
But the early Western horse trade has remained little known for several good reasons. For one thing, during the period when Spain was still hanging on to the Southwest until the success of the Mexican War of Independence in 1821, in other words, removal of wild horses was illegal without having Spanish authority or permission. So in the 1780s, Spain had proclaimed all these horses to be the property of the king. Well, nevertheless, American horse traders who followed in Nolan's footsteps never bothered to get either a passport or a license from the Spanish authorities, and eventually the horse trade would acquire kind of a bad reputation for supplying Indians with guns and encouraging raiding. And so for nearly its entire history, the Western horse trade was kind of an underground economy carried on by people who largely did not want to draw attention to themselves. Well, when the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 drove the Spaniards out of New Mexico, the Navajos, the Utes, the Shoshones, the Salish, the Nez Perces, Blackfeet, Crow, Cayuses, Crees, throughout the northwestern Canada, they had all these horses, and a lot of them escaped out just to run wild. Now, another source of wild horses in the Southwest were the abandoned early missions of Texas, from which the Franciscans, the monks, turned out both mares and stallions. So there again, you've got a source where you're going to get a lot of horses. So the wild horse herds by Nolan's time had grown to huge, huge numbers. And one mid-19th century Texas rancher reported, he said, quote, immense herds all over the western country as far as the eye or telescope can sweep the horizon. The whole country seemed to be running. And then there was a Texas ranger, his name was John Duval, and he said, quote, nothing over the dead level prairie was visible except a dense mass of horses, and the trampling of their hooves sounded like the roar of the surf on the rocky coast. Now, Zeb, I heard of wild horses, but I didn't realize that there's such a huge amount, thousands and thousands.
No, I hadn't either. I have a question for you, if you don't mind, because you know everything, okay? Now, didn't you say that this man, Philip Nolan, sold earlier, you were talking, I think, 1,500 head of horses, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you said he sold them for $150 a head, right?
Right.
Okay. So we're talking $225,000, right? Okay. In those days, my question is, where did they get the money? Where did they have the available funds? They didn't just go down to a local bank and draw on a check or whatever. Where did they go to get all the money and the funding?
You know, I have no idea because, you know, he took them to sell, and maybe there was just enough buyers that they all bought a little here and a little there until they got them all sold. So that is a huge amount that, you know. But, you know, a lot of the Indian people participated in the horse trade, too. But when American traders entered the game, the Comanches, they kind of controlled and put their stamp on it. And through the 18th century, they effected a kind of a cultural and economic transformation, becoming not just bison hunters and raiders, but the most horse people in all of the Western history,
mm-hmm.
Comanches. They caught, they bred, and raided for horses, and they managed to get bigger and bigger herds. And when Americans first encountered the Comanches, they were absolutely amazed at the number of horses and mules that they owned. But they also traded them north to horse-poor tribes up in the northern part, and they would give them away to try to make friends with, like, the Kiowas, the Cheyennes, the Wichitas. But about this time, Vice President Jefferson first heard about Philip Nolan and his wild horses, and he was convinced he needed to meet this man. So in 1799, Jefferson wrote Nolan asking to buy one of his quote, Western animals, and which he says, I am told are so remarkable for the singularity and beauty of their colors and forms. Well, in May of 1800, Nolan actually left for Monticello with letters of introduction and a beautiful paint stallion for this future president. Well, something went wrong. Possibly somebody in Kentucky offered Nolan more money for the paint than he could refuse. Or maybe he lost the horse in gambling. Who knows? But however close they got, Nolan and Jefferson never did actually meet. Well, that fall, Nolan left on his fifth wild horse expedition. So now we're in 1800, headed out west. And before leaving Natchez, he had two dozen good men and was taking a big quantity of trade goods. This time, however, he did not have a passport or permission from the Spanish officials. This was not good. So to Nolan's favorite Mustangian country south of present-day Fort Worth, Texas, this is where they built some corrals, and they began to run horses in what they called the Grand Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in March of 1801, a Spanish force sent out to arrest him. They located his camp, and Nolan refused to surrender. Well, the Spaniards attacked, and a single shot hit Nolan square in the forehead.
Uh-oh.
That pretty much put an end to his dreams and everything else. The Spaniards captured more than a dozen of Nolan's men, although seven of them actually did escape. But Nolan's adventures were over, but word had gotten out. The West had a wealth in the form of horses. It was dangerous business, and Nolan, of course, lost his life, and others had been arrested. But he and his group had actually made, in one herd, just $60,000 on just one smaller herd. So, you know, it's that for this part of early history, the horse trading remained kind of an underground economy. They kind of had to sneak in and get the horses and get back out.
Well, I think it goes without question that if people really are fair and honest in giving an appraisal of what really helped build this nation, it was the horse. Whether it was the eastern seaboard with all the carriage horses and the pack horses and everything else that was used to get transportation from the seaports inland, or whether it was the old west with the mountain men going all the way to the cattle ranching, etc., the horse honestly built this great country, the United States of America.
Well, and if you think about the Lewis and Clark expedition,
yes,
you know, they were saved by the fact that they were finally able to get some horses and be able to continue their journey.
That's right. And you know, the horse business itself is still, I believe, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it is the third largest agricultural industry in the United States, the horse industry. I think it's still up there with all the different attractions to it. So, I mean, we're very blessed to have a strong horse industry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, while the West, these early Mustangers and horse traders, you know, they kind of kept a low profile. Some of their stories and adventures have come down to us. In fact, one, in 1794-95, there was a 27-year-old guy, a Philadelphia gunsmith named John Calvert, and he spent 14 months chasing horses with the Wichitas and the Comanches before a Spanish patrol snagged him. But two horse traders from this era kind of stand apart, because they actually left first-hand accounts of their experiences in a journal, like this one guy in a 10-month expedition in 1808 and 9, a guy by the name of Anthony Glass. He described the sort of adventure that probably Nolan had years before.
Mm.
But he left a fascinating kind of a representation of the horse trader's life. He described the difficulties of bartering with the Wichitas and the Comanches, and you know, they didn't want to trade their best horses. It took a bit of ingenuity to trade with the Indians. Now, the other account comes from a horse trader. His name is Thomas James, and he wrote a book called 3 Years Among the Indians and Mexicans. And this describes his two trips into the Oklahoma Plains. Now, that's a little later, between 1821 and 1824. But there's no guarantee the Comanches wouldn't immediately steal back the horses that you just traded for. So, you didn't know once you took off if a few days down the road you were going to get attacked or, you know, and those horses would all come back.
Of all the tribes, Dr. History, I've got to ask you this. Of all the tribes of Indians in the United States, it has been asserted that the Comanches were absolutely the greatest horsemen of all time. I'm sure you've probably heard that.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, you look at the different breeds, and, you know, of course, the Nez Perce with their Appaloosas.
Right.
You know, I mean, amazing horses. But, you know, this Thomas James, like I say, he had gotten some horses, and they had a herd of 323 really nice animals, and they started back to St. Louis. But a horse trader needed a little bit of luck. And this guy seemed fresh out of luck. He had disasters. He had stampedes, hordes of horseflies, theft, one thing after another. By the time the party made St. Louis, they had five horses.
Five?
They had five horses left out of 323.
Oh, my goodness sakes. Wow. You know, I was really not aware of all the different trail drives, if you will, of horses going back into the center of our country, Missouri, St. Louis area, whatever it is. Are there more reports about many more of the capture and the trailing of horses back to the eastern part of the country?
You know, when you think about trailing animals, you really don't hear much about horse herds being, you know, by the thousands being taken, you know. But, you know, in the 1880s, they estimated that there was at least 50,000 wild horses still living, you know, in West Texas. And, you know, it gradually, of course, got less and less. But, in fact, you know, there was a point where ranchers actually paid their cowboys to shoot some of these horses on site because they were, you know, they were taking up cattle grazing.
That's
land
right.
And,
that's right.
You know, but so, you know, it was a fascinating thing. Of course, we still have wild horses down in the Nevada area, you know, and you know, there's a little controversy on that. But anyway, as a horse lover, you know, you and I, we cannot stand the thought of a horse being shot or mistreated.
Well, yeah, that's all well and good, but then on the other hand, mistreatment is a two-way street to where if they're taking away forage and food that is paid for by the ranchers and desecrating and depriving the livestock of their daily dues to survive, then there's got to be some management to get them off that range.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and you know, I've read some things about lately in the, you know, later 1900s, that 1945, 1970, 76, that, you know, there's things going on to kind of care for these animals. So.
Well, it takes a lot of money, my friend, and money does rule the world, unfortunately.
Well, and, you know, with cattle, you can eat a cow, but at least I've never eaten a horse, I don't think.
Well, just don't go to France. Okay. Listen, great...
have the chance, but I make sure that what I'm eating is not a horse.
All right. Well, listen, I want to tell you how much I enjoyed your story. And any word from, you said, I've got a minute left, but you said every week you wanted to thank various people and acknowledge various people. Do you have anybody today?
You know, I do not. I haven't heard from anybody this past week. And so, yeah, just go to dr-history.com and send me a message. And I appreciate the... Actually, I just met a man here just a few minutes ago here that has some information about the town of Bliss and also a book on the post offices of southern Idaho.
Oh, okay.
They're no longer in existence, some of these little post offices that were around, you know.
All right.
He's going to give me that information.
Well, I tell you what, you always do a phenomenal job, and you can tune in every week, ladies and gentlemen, right here on Zeb at the Ranch and listen to Dr. History. And I want to thank you very much. Next week, let's try to see if we can't entertain thoughts of being in the same studio. It's a lot more fun than being on the phone.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, my friend.
We'll just have to see what happens.
All right. God bless you, man. Thanks much.
Thanks, Ed.
All right. I really appreciate him. Dr. History on the air with us this morning. Thank you very much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.